Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Fi podcast. My name is Doug Cunnington, and today we're hanging out with Neil. And how's it going today, Neil?
Doing great.
So, Neil, you emailed me with an inspiring story of perseverance, self-improvement, and financial growth. So we're going to go over some of your, well, your life story overall. So you sent a lot of cool details. And one of the reasons why I did want to talk to you was when Carl left the show, I was like, what kind of content do I want to have? And more importantly, like, what does the audience want to hear too? So I was checking out a lot of the details in the Facebook group, and people want like case studies. They want to hear like real stories where maybe people aren't retired yet. And that's kind of like what we're going to get into here. So you're sort of in progress, and we're going to learn about how you, well, your, you know, early years, your beginnings, how you found the FI movement, what you're working on now, challenges moving forward. So before we get into some of the FI details, I want to learn a little bit about your background. So like, what kind of work do you do these days, and where do you live? You're actually local, which is why we're able to do this in the studio and everything. So where do you live? What's your day job? What do you do?
I live south of here in a little town called Erie, Colorado. I work for a small business here in Longmont called AIM Dynamics. We mostly sell industrial power mining equipment to installers and big companies. Because it's a small company, it's nice because I get to kind of do a little bit of everything there. Depending on the day, I'm shipping, or I'm fielding customer concerns, or I'm, you know, doing purchasing or whatever. So it's always interesting.
Got it. We'll get into a lot of the backstory as we go, but like, how did you find the FIRE movement or FI? Like, you live close by to like the Mecca, as people call it, Longmont, Colorado, where a lot of the FIRE people live, and more people are moving around here. So when did it show up on your radar?
About 9 years ago. I had been driving an old 1999 Toyota Camry, and it was at over 200,000 miles. And I said, it's time to get a new car. And it was a gift. And I had never, ever had a car payment ever. And so I said, I'm going to have to figure out this car payment thing. I need to look at this. And it really was a time to do some soul searching and figure out. I don't think at that time I'd ever done a budget. I think I had kind of looked at them, but I'd never done one. And so I said, I need to sit down and see basically what I'm spending and figure out how I can make a budget and see if I can afford a car payment or whatever, right? It was kind of a wake-up call. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what sparked my just wanting to get ahead. And then one day I was at home surfing YouTube, and I stumbled onto this video from, I think it was CBS Sunday Morning or something. They were interviewing Mr. Money Mustache, and he's like riding around. He's talking to them, and I'm like, that looks like Longmont. That looks like where I work. And all of a sudden I look him up, and sure enough, he's in Longmont. And I was like, this nondiscreet building that I drive by to work every single day is the Mr. My Mustache headquarters. Uh-huh. And I got so curious about that building. I got so curious. And then I found podcasts, multiple podcasts. And that is what started my journey. It was the need for that car and to figure out my finances really is what the wake up call was.
Okay. And so you moved to the Colorado area about 9 years ago. And then after a few years after that, that's when you were like going to get a new car.
Yeah. 2 years after that, it was okay. Time and yeah.
Got it. What car did you get?
I got a 2007 Camry.
Okay. well, they last a long time. Okay, good. You're happy with that car? I take it.
That car's been totaled. Then I got a 2011 Camry. And now okay. I have a 2012 Camry.
Okay. Well, you have a type.
Yes.
Okay, cool. So you started looking a little bit closer at your budget. Let's rewind a little bit. Like, did you have good sort of money habits growing up? It sounds like you didn't touch a budget, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not good at handling money. Maybe you just, you know, had it kind of understood. So yeah, what was it like growing up?
I think this is one of the places of my life where maybe I was lucky. My family did pretty well growing up. whenever I needed money, it seemed to kind of arrive. Like a birthday would come, or, you know, some situation would come where I could go earn some quick money. But as far as when I was younger in high school and stuff, whenever I needed money, it seemed to come. My dad gave my sister and I allowance, which, you know, was a little bit of money. And then, you know, we had everything at home. So it was pretty easy. And then when I went to college, again, I got a job. I worked a little bit. My school, luckily, my parents could afford to cover school. And so I covered kind of incidentals, my personal stuff. They also covered housing. And I never went into debt, because just kind of when the money was low, I would get some more, or, you know, and most of what I bought at that time was stuff I wanted to buy. It wasn't need based. So.
Okay. Got it. So you didn't go into debt, which is big.
Mm-hmm.
So at least you were starting like at zero.
At college. Yeah. In college.
Okay. Perfect. And then you discovered the FI movement because you were budgeting just a few years ago. So did you start changing a lot of things, your spending, your savings? Were you investing more for the future? And how did that come about?
I did change a lot because I wasn't paying attention. I mean, that was a lot of it. Like when I did finally sit down and do that budget, I was actually surprised that if I put reasonable numbers on categories, I would have, it wasn't a ton of money, but I had $300 left over. And so I said, oh, well, if I can buy a car with the $300 payment, you know, I'll be good. Mm-hmm. And a big kicker too was, at the time I had roommates, and my one roommate told me about the 50-20-30 budget. And I was just looking at, you know, okay, how can I find this money? But once I had a framework to kind of shove everything into, that was a big wake up call, because after I did all my needs, I didn't have any groceries. I didn't have any money for groceries. I was out of money. I didn't realize that I was spending like that. And so then for the first several months that I was, maybe the first year, my groceries and food and whatnot fit into my wants. I wanted to eat. So.
Okay. What is that budget for people that don't know the framework?
So the 50-20-30 is based on the concept that 50% of your income needs to go to your needs, housing, transportation, food, depending on your personal thoughts. It could be medical or other things, just needs, whatever you need. 20% is considered future or debt. So if you have debt, you want to be putting at least 20% of your total income towards that debt. If you don't have debt, then that's supposed to be your retirement savings or investments or whatever. And then the 30% is your wants. So anything else fun that you want to do, if you like skiing, then that's what you do. Or if you, you know, want to buy a new guitar, or mm-hmm. just anything fun falls into the 30%. And it helped me a lot to have a framework of baskets to put every single expense into.
Okay. Got it. Yeah, it's a great framework, especially like if you were, you know, coming at the direction that you mentioned, or I think back when similar situation. So when I bought my first house, I think I had a job for like a couple of years. I can't remember exactly, but I traveled a lot. So I house hacked / had roommates with my coworkers because we were gone except for the weekends, basically. So when I was looking to buy a house, I was like, oh, I need to put a budget together. And of course, like some things I go look up, like phone costs, like transportation. I didn't have a car payment, a couple other things like that. But then I like never revisited it after I got the mortgage, and then basically I probably didn't save enough, or at least like not consistently. I was like, oh, I got a raise, I'm just going to put that towards a 401k, which is a good move, but I wasn't looking at it. And it would have been a stretch at the time, I think, to save the, you know, the 20%, depending on what was going on. So anyway, it's a good way to like wrangle people in. And I think longtime listeners of the show, or more advanced people, like after, you know, someone holds their expenses at a certain level and they're like, I'm happy, but their income keeps going up, then they're like, that's when they start saving like whatever, 50, 60% or something. Okay. So in your email, you mentioned some life challenges and I'm going to list them out here. So you went through a tough divorce, foreclosure, financial instability. Like looking back, are there any key moments that pushed you to rethink how you approach life and money?
I'd say a big key situation was after I stopped going to college, I moved to another state and I said, I think the American dream, I'm going to buy a house. And so I bought a new build in a neighborhood in Texas and I didn't even have a job there. I just bought it. I was like, I'll figure it out. I'll get some roommates. So I bought that house and went there, found a job, and the job was paying me less than the job I'd come from, which was a part of the problem. And then I started dating somebody at the time and moved way too quick. We got married because we moved so quick. We got divorced less than a year later. And then probably because of the stress of that or whatever, I ended up losing my job at work and basically had to leave the house and move away from Texas because I couldn't find any work at the time. So I went back to where I'd come from in Arizona because I knew that I could get work there. Mm-hmm. And I did try to rent the house, but in hindsight, it's easy to see, but it didn't cover the mortgage. I thought, I'll just cover the difference and whatever. And eventually I just was out of work again. And I just had to let the house go. Luckily it was in 2007, 2008 is when this whole housing crash happened. And it's when I owned the house and I was afraid when I let it go that maybe the bank wouldn't have been able to get the value of the house to cover the mortgage. Luckily, later when I was brave enough to look at like the actual numbers, it had covered it. And I think the bank ended up with like an extra $20,000 or something, you know, for what they sold it for. So,
wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. So I didn't owe anything on the house. It did stay on my credit for 7 years. You know, I spent a lot of money on it, but ultimately I was able to walk away kind of, you know, free of it.
Interesting. Yeah, I had a similar situation, roughly the same time frame or so, where I bought at the height of the market. And then it didn't work out, but led it to go into foreclosure. And it worked out to be like one of the best financial decisions I made. Like pretty hard and hard to get advice if you ask people. No, like very few people have done that. And then most people would advise you not to do it. I mean, and I was in a position where I was like, I don't need to get a loan for a long time. So it was fine, but yeah, a little scary to go through. And then I was going to say the 7 years, funny enough, like when we closed on this house, it was like 7 years in one day or something like that. We had to move the closing out. They were like, we can't let you buy this house. We can't let you buy this house like 2 days before because of that foreclosure. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Like this has been like, we could pay cash for it. Like why, like what is the holdup? You think one day is going to make a difference here? So anyway, but those are the rules you got to play by. So, okay, let's go a little bit deeper into the FI discussion. So you had like a roller coaster past, some ups and downs. You started budgeting. Did you immediately think, hey, I want to like try to retire earlier than like the normal path? And have you mapped it out? Do you have projections? Just talk about that part of it.
In short, yeah, I would love to retire early. When I look at the projections and stuff, I think retiring on time is kind of a goal that I could achieve. And that's an exciting, I guess, stretch goal for me. If I could retire earlier, that would be amazing. But right now, just being able to be financially independent is the primary focus right now for me. I've mapped it out. I've looked at the numbers and done a lot of calculating for, you know, what's inflation going to be? And, you know, what am I going to need in 25 years when I finally retire? Like, what's it going to be? One thing that I think about a lot and that I've had trouble finding and was a big wake up call to me was kind of what an average person in America was. And I think about this a lot. You know, am I average? Am I above average? You know, like I know a lot of people in the FIRE community are better off than the average person because there's, you know, something like, oh, they have average of X amount of debt and they have average of, you know, no retirement funds and stuff. It was a big wake-up call. I think I saw an article, and this was probably in 2018, 2017, that said that the average income in America was like $40,000. And at that time, I don't think I was making that much, or I was pretty close to it, but I thought, okay, this is a good gauge, you know? And when I got above that, I felt, okay, well, I'm above average. You know, this is a good place to be. A lot of times I think about me though, which is something that's basically impossible to find. It's like, what other, you know, 40 something male that lives in Colorado that has, you know, the education that level that I have, you know, where are they in their life and how do I measure up? Right. So it gets a little difficult to find that, but I think a lot about where the average is and try to stay above that in the hopes that that will make up for my kind of late start.
It's hard. It's very interesting to go and look at those averages. And I think a lot matters about like the geography, right? So it's just like some places are way more expensive to live and you don't need as much in other spots that are way cheap. Obviously, cost of living is a huge factor. And the lifestyle too. I mean, if you live in a place, I think back to Atlanta when I had a corporate job and I had to drive like a long way, like gas and transportation and maintenance was like a significant cost. But now, like, I hardly drive at all. So it's so much less. And I mean, we have to make assumptions on like the expenses, but we know we're going to, like, the only thing we know is we're going to be wrong about whatever the expenses are because of inflation or other life fact. Like, what if you like move, right? Or what if we're like, oh, you know what? We're going to pay off the mortgage. We're like, oh, we'd rather just not have a mortgage, even though it's not the best financial decision based on the interest rate that we have, but maybe we sleep better at night because of that. All right. So let's talk about the plan. You mentioned that you've done a lot of research. It sounded like you geeked out. You listen to podcasts, YouTube videos. Like, do you have a specific approach? Is it a standard one? Like, just talk about what you arrived at through all your research and what works for you.
I find that I thrive in, I guess, for lack of a better word, just boring, like being boring. That's when I tend to have the most success. Structure. My budget is based on kind of previous year. I look at that. That's a big benefit. Once you can get through a year of a budget, you can look at your previous year and you can say, oh, you know, yeah, this month I have to spend more because maybe I buy Christmas presents or, you know, pay my 6 month premium on my auto insurance. And then you can average that out so that you're basically setting aside the same amount of money every single month. That is a big benefit to me to just, I look at my budget and yeah, there's tweaks. I mean, there's always a few tweaks, but I look at my budget every month and I have a good baseline to start from. And then, you know, based on that, I do some tweaks and stuff. I find a big help to my finances was getting in, like I said, being boring, like getting in a habit. Like, I get up every morning, I go to the gym at the same time every morning. I tell people one of the most important things that has helped me is not setting alarm for when I need to wake up, but setting alarm for when I need to go to bed. Like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Smart. Yeah. It's funny. Like, I, you know, I'm an adult, but I give myself a bedtime and it makes the next day so much better. Right. So yeah. If I just stick to it.
Yeah. It's funny. Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, was recording with me a couple weeks ago and yeah, he was like, if you can just make sure you don't have to set an alarm clock by going to bed at the right time, like, change your life by just going to bed at the right time, a consistent time. That's one of the best things you could do, by the way, is just like have the routine, like don't stay up too late. I mean, sometimes, right, there's a special occasion or whatever, and that's fine. But, it, you know, if you could do it like 80% of the time, don't stay up like too late and like totally fuck up your weekend / you know, Monday, Tuesday, where you're like essentially like jet lagged, which you're a pro, Neil. Let's talk about our sponsor, GhostBed. Thanks for transitioning into sleep. So GhostBed sponsors the show. I have the Lux. It is a little softer than some of their other models, but they have a bunch of them. And if you are interested, you can take their 3-minute sleep quiz. But I'm curious, it sounds like you have your sleep dialed in because you have a bedtime set. You have an alarm. So what time does that alarm go off? What's your bedtime routine to like lead you into slumber?
I get up at 4:30 every morning, 4 to 4:30 to hit the gym. So I want to get at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep. So I have an alarm that goes off at 8 p.m. And at that time, it's whatever I'm doing, I'll assess. I'll say, oh, you know, should I go to bed, or, you know, should I watch another episode or whatever? And usually I'm good and I don't stay up too much later. But yeah, then I, you know, get ready for bed. I sleep in like a really dark room, like absolutely black. Like, I don't like sleep masks. And if you wake up at 4:30, then the sun hasn't come up either, so it doesn't bother you.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You're okay. Even in the summer, you're like, it's fine.
Yeah. In the summer, it's more light going to bed than it is, you know, waking up.
Yeah. Yeah, that is awkward when you like lay down and the sun's still up in the sky. But I mean, if you're waking up at 4:30, which is really early, so you could wake up without an alarm?
I still have an alarm.
Just in case.
Yeah.
That's earlier than I usually get up. I'll often wake up at like 4, but I'll work really hard to go back to sleep.
Yeah. If it wasn't for, you know, having to get the gym in before work, I'm definitely more of a effective person first thing. Mm-hmm. And so if I try to work out after work, it's never happening. So I just need to get to the gym and do it.
So I have been wearing a sleep mask and it's helped a ton. And I like, you're bald. For the people that can't see, you shave your head too, right? So it's like, it's hard to keep a mask on. And some people find it like really uncomfortable, but like I've gotten to a point where like I'm comfortable with it. And I've tried, like, it's hard to get a room really dark, even with like good blinds and blackout curtains. And I put fucking duct tape, like black duct tape on anything with a light on it, you know, like any charger or anything that might shine. So a little crazy on that end, but it still wasn't dark enough. There's still like a little light, or even, I mean, we can't complain at the moon, right? Like it rises, but about once a month, the moon is full and it's bright and it like shines through. So how do you keep the room so dark? What do you do?
Yeah, we have really dark shades. Mm-hmm. I think they're room darkening shades even. So I keep it really dark. But like you said, like in the past, I had a charger with a blue light, like a blue LED light. And it's amazing how much light that produces. Like I'd wake up in the night and it'd just be beaming in my eye. And so, yeah, I, you know, either I have to turn it off or unplug it, or I have to put tape over it if I'm going to be using it. And I get it. It wants you to know that it's on, but it's so bright.
Yeah. And if we're at an Airbnb, sometimes the appliances will have like the clock showing like in the kitchen or whatever. So we'll like throw towels and like, yeah, I end up looking like a psycho, like trying to cover every light. So anyway, GhostBed is awesome. They have a 101 night at home sleep trial. So you could test out the mattress, really understand if you enjoy it or not. Full range of sleep related products. You can save 50% with the code MileHiFi, or you can go to ghostbed.com/MileHiFi. So back on topic here. So you have your plan, and we haven't mentioned it yet, but how far along are you, let's say like percentage wise, on meeting your eventual goal?
I would say that I'm about 20% as far as my goal net worth for retiring. It's been 7 years. I wish I was further along, but I also recognize that I basically started at zero. Like that was another big wake up call when I was first doing my budget. I punched all of my numbers into Mint. At the time, I did have some credit card debt that I'd actually been holding for several years since my divorce. And when I punched all the numbers in, it said my net worth was negative. And I was shocked. Like, I mean, it wasn't a lot. I mean, it was less than $10,000 negative, but okay. The wake up call of, you know, I owe money more than, you know, I'm worth, was a big wake up call. Mm-hmm. So starting there to a significant move in net worth, 20% towards my goal has been exciting. But I don't know. Some might say it's fast. I think it's average speed.
Did you have any specific challenges when you were working on your budget where you're like, this is like much higher line item than I want it to be for what it is? Like, can I tweak it? Did you have any of those where you were like, I can cut costs here, and maybe you had to work at it a little bit?
Like I said, when I first did my budget, I used Mint, which is no longer, well, it's different, but I imported the last 3 months of transactions and I meticulously went through them and said, you know, this is groceries, this is eating out, this is whatever. And I realized, I think at the time I was spending, you know, I was single, I was spending $700-$800 on food, whether it be eating out, whether it be groceries, whatever. And I said, wow, that's a lot of money. I could definitely do better on that. And I think at first I dialed it back to like 300. Like I said, oh, I can dial this back to 300. And it was a struggle. And unfortunately, I couldn't live on $300 worth of food today because of, you know, increasing prices and whatever. Right. But yeah, that was a big conscious effort. And towards the end of the month, I had to be conscious about, okay, well, you know, I don't have any more grocery money. I guess I'm going to look in my cupboard and, you know, find a can of soup or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like it forces you to be more aware.
I want to dig into that and we'll see how granular. We'll try to push away the audience. So stick with me on this one. So you look strong, Neil. You work out in the morning, so it sounds like you're serious about it. And one thing that I don't compromise on now is like food, because it's like the fuel in your body. And if you're working out, it's like you're trying to hit macros, you're trying to get enough protein. And a lot of times unhealthy food is cheap and processed and not really what you want to eat. And for me, we actually end up eating in most of the time now. And I think, you know, when I had a corporate job, I ate out more because maybe you ended up going out for lunches more often, or I was unhappy and I was like, I want to get out of here. I worked hard, so I want to spend some money, and I would go out. So I'm curious, were you eating out a lot? How did you trim from 700 to 300, which was a little bit too low? And I think these days it would be too low, but yeah, were you eating out a lot? Like was there waste? What was going on?
Yeah, it was a lot of eating out. I think it was kind of a mindset of, I'm making good money. I can go spend $15 on lunch every day, you know, go out to eat. I think a big factor was kind of those, I think that fast casual was kind of becoming like way more prominent. And it was crazy because all of a sudden, instead of spending, you know, $10 at McDonald's, everything at fast casual was $15, mm-hmm. right? And you think, oh, it's not much, but over a month, that really adds up. Yeah. And so being conscious about not about making my lunch, right? That's another aspect. If I was at work without lunch, I'd be like, oh, well, I guess I'll just go get something. Or now our office happens to be across the street from a grocery store. So if I don't bring a lunch, I'll actually walk over to the grocery store and I usually go to the wall of the salad bags. And, yep. And I look for the ones that are like on clearance that are like about, you know, they're going to expire in 2 days. Cause I'm going to eat it in 20 minutes. I don't care. Yeah. So I'll get the one that's cheap and I'll go back to the office and throw it in a bowl and that'll be my lunch.
Got it. Okay. So yeah. And eating out, and the thing is like the fast casual, that's like Chipotle. And what are some other places like that?
Chipotle, I'd say, is probably the most prominent, but okay. Like Noodles and Company, oh, right. Cafe Rio, or Costa Vida, depending on where you live. Anywhere where, you know, it's a little more of a sit downy place. They usually don't have a drive through. You got to walk in. Now they're the big way that they make money is with DoorDash or stuff, which that even adds another $2 to every meal, right? So now all of a sudden you can DoorDash a meal and it's $20 now. So,
yeah. Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. So like I said, at this point, I'm not compromising on food. We reached a point where I'm just like, okay, if we want to get some stuff, and usually it's like Whole Foods, right? Like I try to stay out of the processed food aisles, especially like sweets. And at the time we're recording this, it's like the holiday season. And there's like all these, like, it's like peppermint bark. Man, I love candy and stuff and sweets. And my wife, she's actually like baking pies upstairs right now, which is bananas. So there's like all these temptations around. Anyway, the point is protein is expensive. It's like the most expensive thing. And if you're trying, do you count your macros? Are you watching that stuff?
right now, I'm not as focused on it. I have been in the past.
Okay.
And you're right. There is eating clean does get expensive, but ultimately when I look at eating clean versus fast food, I still think it's cheaper. I believe. And then there's also, I love a deal. Like I love a deal. I love at every grocery store, they have the little markdown section. I love going there because sometimes, especially if I'm headed home and I don't know what I want for dinner, I love going there because it's like gambling. It's like, what am I going to eat for dinner? It's going to be something out of the markdowns. In the past, I would take advantage of, they'd have a Black Friday deal at where I'd buy my protein powder, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'd go buy 6 tubs of protein powder, you know, because it's going to last me 4 months. And it's, you know, they're buy one, get one half off or something. Yeah, and so that if you can plan ahead, there's ways to mitigate that cost, but it's your time.
Those are great though. I exactly do those things. Even though I'm saying, hey, I will spend on food. I also like a deal. So pro tip out there, especially Sam's. So we have like the Sam's Plus membership. So you can go at 8 a.m. instead of 10. And the thing is, if you go in on like a Monday morning, it's like after the weekend where they had the steaks and all the meat like packaged up. So you find a lot of markdowns. And that's where I'm like, oh, I'm going to buy like whatever, like 30 pounds of pork butt or something like that. I'm like, okay, I'm getting it all. This is super cheap. Or like you said, I'm just going to like buy it. I'm going to cook whatever, a couple trays of chicken, like all today, and then freeze, you know, 3/4 of it. And then we have like prepackaged like protein ready to go. So yeah, when it's a good deal, like you got to be ready to strike and like cook the food. Same deal with a protein powder. I'll go in. I won't mention the store, but it's probably the same one. Places make deals all the time, right? But yeah, you end up saving whatever, like $40 or something. You're spending $150 or so on these giant tubs, which I have a bunch of them laying over there. but then I'm like, yeah, this is a whole quarter worth of like protein powder.
Well, and the expiration date on it, I think it's like 2 years or something. So So I'm going to use it. I know I'm going to use it. And if I'm planning ahead and conscious enough, it's like I've already been setting aside that money so that when I see the Labor Day deal or whatever, I can take advantage of it, jump on it, right?
So let's talk about the budgeting apps. So you said you used Mint before, which is kind of like net worth tracking, which is now like they closed it down like about a year ago or so. And what do you use now? Do you use an app? Do you just track a spreadsheet?
After Mint closed down, I moved over to Monarch Money. Various podcasts had talked about it. From what I understand, the original owner of Mint, the original creator of Mint, created Monarch. They sold it. They sold Mint to Intuit years ago. And I think they must have signed a do not compete or something, but it expired. So they released Monarch Money. The benefit of Mint was it was free. Mm-hmm. The downside of Mint was there was ads and stuff and they offer you credit cards and things. Monarch Money, you have to pay for it, but the benefit that I see from it is worth the $100 a year that it costs me or whatever. Like it way outweighs the cost. Like it's money well spent in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's interesting. I talked to a couple other or one other founder of a budgeting software app. And it's called My Budget Coach. So shout out to Zach and his team out there. But it's interesting because they're trying to like have a budgeting app, but there's also like contextual help. So basically like if you don't understand like what this little section is for, like some of the software can be like not so intuitive and you need help to understand how to use it. So they have like avatars, like actual coaches, but like financial coaches that like pre-record messages. And at this certain point, if you're like, oh, I don't know what this is, I need some tips, like you can click, you know, hey, what is this thing? And it explains it. So it's kind of a cool concept to help people start using budget software. Now, you've used Mint or Monarch for several years now, right?
Yeah.
So do you have... I haven't used any of the budgeting apps. So typically, honestly, I just suck at doing the budget portion of it. And I ended up doing more expense tracking afterwards. But once you dial it in, you kind of have it down. which is similar to you. Like, you like the boring. Sounds like you like habits. So you dialed it in. You kind of know what you're spending. If you don't deviate from what you normally do, then you probably should be okay. So do you still get a benefit from like using Monarch versus like not? Like, what benefit does it give you now that you got the routine down?
Yes, I do get a benefit because I benefit from the trends, right? Like I said, planning the next year, I want to look at the previous year's worth of spending. Insurance goes up, other expenses go up, or depending on the year, maybe I'm feeling a little more generous towards my family and I give gifts that are a little bit more expensive. And then the next year I need to rein it in. So the day-to-day tracking of it, and especially the trends, help a lot. It also helps me to put, I guess, money in buckets, right? Like, some people have a philosophy of, I just have an emergency fund and it's this big emergency fund and it's for whatever. I don't feel confident in that personally. So after I built up an emergency fund, then I was like, okay, well, I'm going to build up a medical deductible, mm-hmm. right? So I need to build up enough money to have a deductible. And now that doesn't have to come out of my emergency fund. I am going to start making car payments to myself for the next vehicle when I need to buy a next vehicle. And so the budgeting helps me allocate all those things so that my emergency fund is strictly for emergencies, because I'm keeping everything else in its own pocket, right?
Out of curiosity, how much or how many months does your emergency fund cover you for?
Right now, I guess it's 3 months worth of emergency funds. That's something I need to revisit right now. I set it up 4 or 5 years ago. I figured out all my stuff. I figured out what I need to spend. I stripped down everything to what could I live on for food? What's my car insurance cost? What's gas going to cost me? What I'm going to need to do a Cobra if I lose medical insurance and stuff. And at that time I figured it out for 6 months. And so I have that, but at this point I think that it's probably more like 3 months worth of emergency fund. So I need to reevaluate that and also beef it up more.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I talked to someone not too long ago and they maybe needed to hit their emergency fund because layoffs and other, life changes and stuff. And they were like, oh yeah, we had like a 6 month emergency fund, but inflation and then moving like made it not sufficient. Like they were like, oh, this is not nearly enough. Our expenses are way different than what we projected 5 years ago or whatever. So that all that makes sense. That's a great answer, Neil, on like the value of using a budgeting app and staying on top of it. And I'm lucky Elizabeth is like in the budget all the time, like does expense tracking. Like since she was in college or whatever and had to manage her own money, I think like would look on a weekly basis and like save her receipts and like do all the spreadsheet stuff. So I'm lucky that she's on top of it. Yeah. Cause I can do it, but I mean, I manage budgets for like projects in my corporate job, but yeah, here at home, I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm sloppy, you know?
Yeah. Getting into the weeds in it. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it. I know other people don't enjoy it. It's not necessarily what they really love to do, but it is definitely important to have kind of an overview. I mean, I imagine you have an overview of the situation. Mm-hmm. If you can look at it and see where trends are happening and stuff, right? Even if you're not in the individual stuff.
Yeah. I'm more aware than I probably let on. So I just want to make Elizabeth look good. So one more thing on expenses, and then we'll look at the other side because there's only so much that you can cut. I switched to Mint Mobile about a year ago and it's awesome. So I was on one of the big carriers for many years. I was paying, back in those days, it was like $120 or so for both me and my wife. And now we've switched over to Mint. The coverage is awesome. We have no issues. And now we're only paying like $180 each per year, so it's 360. So we've saved like over $1,000 like in the last year just from switching to Mint. So I'm curious, are you on Mint or some other discount carrier already?
Yeah, I'm on a...
Don't tell me what it is if it's not Mint.
It's not Mint.
Okay. So you're on you're another cheaper
one. But yeah, when I did do the budget, I used to be a Verizon member, and it was so expensive. When I first started doing the budget, I was like, I'm cutting this $120 a month bill down. And it's an easy thing to cut down. It's low hanging fruit. So if you're on, I definitely don't recommend being on, especially on a plan of your own, on one of the big major ones, because they're just so expensive. They're so inflated.
It's crazy. Yeah. And I was talking to my sister who has a family of four, and it's like, they're paying a lot. They're paying like hundreds of dollars per month. And I was like, you have to switch. Like, it will immediately save you so much money. And I know it's a little bit of a hassle if you have to move like four phones, and it's like daughters are in college, and it's like, it's a slightly more complicated, but it's just like, get off, like pay off your phone if you're making payments, because they always give you the payment plan for new phones and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, check out Mint. They've been great partners. I'm a user myself. I've tried to tell people like it's a very easy way to just like save a significant amount of money for, I mean, it seems to be like no downside from what I could tell. A couple times traveling, I've gone a little bit more on data usage because I'm looking more stuff up. I'm not on Wi-Fi as often. It's super easy to add more data to your plan, where if you were on one of the big carriers, it's like, oh, they're going to charge you some crazy amount, but you could just like incrementally add like a gig or whatever you need. So very flexible, really like Mint. They've been they're a new partner, so happy to be working with them. All right. So we have two parts of the equation, right? So you earn some money and you spend it. So you've cut down your expenses. You've optimized that pretty well. What about the income side? Have you looked at earning more? It's not that it's easy, Neil, but like to earn more money. Like, hey, why don't you just earn like 30% more? But yeah, just other ways. Sometimes it's side hustles. Sometimes it's just optimizing like exactly what you're doing at your job, to like put yourself in a position to get a raise or whatever. So what about that? Is that a big challenge?
I've been able to increase income in various ways. When the pandemic started, I started doing like grocery delivery with one of those apps. You know, I was running around doing a bunch of that. At that time, I actually had some back taxes that I needed to pay. And so I put it in my brain that I was going to run deliveries until I paid off all those taxes. And so I did that. You know, I told my manager about that. And I think that also, you know, he saw my resolve, and he saw that in addition to the job that he thought I was doing good at work, he was seeing that I was, you know, going out and doing this extra stuff. And I think that was some motivation to the next time kind of reviews came around. He was like, well, I want you to be giving that energy to the company. You know, I know you have it and I know you're doing great here, but let me kind of boost your income to maybe you don't have to do that anymore. I purchased a house 2 years ago, which is now a rental. So that's a way to make a little bit of extra income. It doesn't make me much money. I mean, it kind of breaks even, but the way I look at it is it's paying down the mortgage every month. So that money is essentially going into my pocket because of the value. I've also done a bunch of upgrades. They're kind of half done. I need to finish them to really get the full value, but that has added to it. So yeah, there's been multiple ways. I did some day trading for a while, and at moments it was good. Other times it wasn't. I've kind of given it up. I don't think I have the bandwidth right now to give to it. But if you have the energy, if you're willing, I think that there are lots of options out there to make more money, be it at your work or through other means. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm looking right now, I've been posting some stuff on eBay trying to see, you know, oh, well, how will this do? Can I sell some stuff on eBay?
Yeah.
Instead of sitting at home and watching an hour of TV, I'm like, oh, I'll just, you know, go post a few things that I got around the house on eBay. See if they sell, see what they're worth. Yeah.
What's cool, your manager was like, hey, I see that you're working. Like, we want to keep you around. Like, we'll give you a better raise than if you it was like a little leverage you added in there. You were like, hey, like I want it, I need it, I need more money and I'm willing to work for it. So that's pretty awesome. And the, I was going to say the day trading, I haven't looked into the actual stats on day trading, but I think some other podcasts I listen to, I mean, I think the stats are horrible for like profitability. Like, I mean, there's a bunch of people selling products and or like just bullshit online. The internet's a horrible place.
Let me correct. I said day trading. What I meant was I was doing options. I was doing buying and selling options, which is a different animal than day trading. It's in the same vein, but it is slightly different.
yeah. It is different. But in that case, then you could like over leverage and then really like end up in a spot where you're like, I didn't know I could owe that much money based on the shit that I just did. And I don't know much about options, but that's correct, right?
I own some GameStop, but I had like a, I sold like a call on it or whatever. And so I didn't get all the GameStop growth. I sold it when it, you know, went up, you know, 50 cents and not when it went up, skyrocketed. So, okay.
Gotcha. Interesting. Yeah. Well, and to your point earlier, it's just like the boring stuff that works, that is like, you can kind of count on it like that. That's a much safer route. So, okay. So what are some other challenges that you're like facing right now? So you're in the, you know, what people call the boring middle. You have the plan set up, you're willing to be flexible and like look at trends and stuff like that. But what else is standing in your way right now?
The challenges that I've come across right now are kind of my net worth. I felt like at first, and I think it's more of a, I mean, it's like a percentage thing, right? Like if your net worth goes from $20,000 to $40,000, you've doubled it, right? Like, and it feels like a lot of movement. It feels a lot of fast, right? But once you, you know, once you're, you know, above $100,000 or something, right? The same $20,000 doesn't feel as groundbreaking, right? Like, so it feels a little more stagnant and it's hard to stay focused when that's happening. That's something I struggle with is yeah, I know it's growing, but it's hard to be patient, right? You know, but it's not like the nice thing on Mint and also on Monarch Money is it shows you your net worth over time. And so first, you know, your line's going up like this, it's going so fast. And then, you know, it's leveling out and it's still probably, it's maybe even going up faster, but because compared to everything else, it doesn't feel like it's going up as fast. So that's discouraging at times. When I was doing the grocery delivery, just kind of some burnout. If you're thinking about it all the time, you're focusing on it all the time. Sometimes I sit there and I just think, what could I be doing right now? You know, just focusing on it and it gets exhausting sometimes.
Yeah. Obsessing could do that. Well, one thing here is we've probably run across this. There's a few videos that I watched recently where it's just like, oh, you save that first 100K and, you know, maybe that takes 10 years or something. And then I was trying to look up just a blog post that covered it. And then it only took maybe another couple years to save the, you know, the next 50K. And then like, it's compound interest, right? Like it starts growing faster. And once you get that snowball rolling, it's like, oh wow, this is growing much faster than what I thought. So have you, you know, we were vague intentionally about your net worth. So you're 20% of the way to your goal. Like, have you started to see some of the like, hey, this is actually growing a little faster than I thought it was, especially the last couple of years, the market's been pretty great.
I do see that. The thing that I have to keep in mind is one of the things that I've thought of recently is, like I said, I'm about 7 years into this process, right? So they say if with average stock market returns, you should be doubling your money every 7 years, 7 to 10 years, right? And right now, my retirement account hasn't doubled, but that's because not all that money's been there the whole time. You know, like the first $3,000 was there 7 years ago. So yeah, now that's probably $6,000, right? But the next $3,000 from the next year, you know, whatever I put into it, still needs more time to double, right? So it doesn't look as big as I would have expected it or felt like it should look, right?
Right. Yeah, I understand. Well, as we're wrapping up here, This has been great. I appreciate you sending over all the notes and sharing all the details along the way. What I want you to do is talk to someone who's like 7 years, like where you were, right? So like you're at the beginning, you're like, oh shit, I'm actually have a negative net worth. Like I got to dig out before I start accumulating. And then it's a few more years on top of that. We don't have like huge margins between our income and our expenses. So you can't put away like 80%. Like some people are saving huge amounts. So yeah, what advice would you give someone who's maybe at the beginning, they're a little overwhelmed with some of the details?
The biggest benefit I think that anybody could do is looking at it. It's scary. It's scary to look at, but getting the courage and the strength to, like I said, you can import 3 months worth of transactions, spend some time, go through it and just look at the numbers where you're at. That's a big thing. Another big thing for me was becoming like physically and mentally kind of healthy. Before I started getting financially on track, I had already started losing weight and getting focused and stuff. And that helped, that little bit of success helped propel the more ability, the more focus or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying wait to get, don't wait to get healthy before you do it, but definitely make your health a priority and sleep a priority. Have the courage to just look at it and see it for what it is.
Well said. So as we wrap up here, is there any place that you want people to find you? I didn't check with you. Are you on like Instagram or Facebook where you want people to go check it out, or do you want to stay under the radar?
No, I don't have any social media right now.
Cool. That's smart. That's a healthy thing.
Yeah.
But occasionally you show up at the Mr. Money Mustache HQ events. Like that's where I met you originally, maybe a couple years ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been there a few times. I'm on their Discord and.
Okay. Cool. Well, if people are in the area and they happen to go to an event, you might bump into Neil there. So thanks a lot. Really appreciate it today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer. This show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Neil, you mentioned that you went to a timeshare presentation in Breckenridge as well.
Yeah, the same week or maybe a week prior, my girlfriend and I went to the timeshare presentation, and it was interesting. I enjoyed hearing your point of view after I'd experienced it as well.
Okay, it's pretty funny. It's not too bad. So did you stay in the resort? Wait, was it the same thing? It was like Grand Colorado?
I think it was one of their other properties.
Okay.
But I don't remember off the top of my head which property it was.
Okay. So we had Georgie with us, who you met briefly earlier. So they don't allow dogs in the resort area unless you're an owner. So we were freeloaders. However, they do allow dogs in a hotel, a little motel like down the street. So it was fine. It was like technically within a mile of downtown, but like not a very walkable zone. So like we couldn't just like walk outside and head downtown. So it was a little farther away. So it wasn't ideal, but you were still like right next to the mountain. when you, so you stayed at the resort, right?
Yeah, we had a little one bedroom suite there.
Okay. And then how was the presentation? You mentioned like my take was like interesting to hear. So were you guys thinking like, there's no way we're buying this timeshare, like walking in the door, like there's no way? Or what were you thinking when you went in there?
Yeah, we talked about it. We said it's going to be nice to stay here and enjoy a small vacation, but we'd already decided that we weren't going to do it. We've heard so much terrible things about timeshares that we knew that it wouldn't be worth it.
Did they make you question your assumption in their presentation? Because it's pretty fucking convincing, right? Like they have numbers, like they're very confident in what they're talking about. If you ask a question that kind of knocks a hole in something, like they always have an answer. So did they make you question those assumptions?
Yeah, it was interesting because the first thing, neither my girlfriend or I are skiers. And so that's the big draw. And and she loves the beach and we do love the mountains in the summer. But at first they start telling you, well, you can trade, you know, you can, you know, sign up here, but you can trade them anywhere. And you're like, oh, huh, well, you know, maybe. And you think back and forth, but then you come to the conclusion, if I want to go somewhere else, why don't I buy a timeshare somewhere else? Why am I buying a timeshare here just to trade it to somewhere else? It doesn't make any sense. So they ran all the numbers and it was, I don't know, we were sitting there, they kept offering lower and lower. Oh, you can do it, you know, for a full year. Oh, well, you know, now you can do it every other year. Oh, well, you can split it with somebody, you know, they break it down. Then finally, like, we just want to get out of there. We were like, no, we'll think about it, whatever. And then he sends in this one lady and we just didn't want to get charged. So we're like, we got to make sure they say you can go. And this lady comes in and she's trying to offer us like one more deal. Oh, do you want to come for a week or whatever? And we're just like, no, we just want to get out of here. Like, and that was actually the thing that annoyed us the most. It was like, we'd sat through, I think you're required to sit through 90 minutes or something. We'd already sat through it. We told him no so many times. And then she shows up and it's like, really? Like, seriously? So then we're driving home, and in the clarity of the moment, when you're just sitting there talking back and forth, you start adding up the actual expenses and you're like, oh, you know, cause they say you have like a HOA type fee or something. Right. And it's, you know, they're like, oh, it's, you know, $60 a month or something. Right. Yeah. But then when you start thinking about it, you're like, but over a year, like I'm staying, you're signing up for a week. And I'm paying ultimately $700 worth of HOA fee for 1 week of like whatever. And that's when the math really doesn't make sense. We're like, it really does make sense. No, like let's not do this.
Yeah. You could definitely rent those places. Yeah. The math doesn't work at all. The closers are hilarious. And by that time, I don't know, like Elizabeth and I must have given off like a horrible vibe. In fact, yeah, I'm certain we did. But like when they sent in the closer, she didn't even try. I was like, I'm interested in hearing like what you have to say. I was like detached from the situation or something. And it like got her out of her head. So she did her spiel and then like kind of like BS'd with me a little bit. And I was like, okay, we're all set. And I'm like, yeah, there's no way like this deal doesn't work. But it was funny to have the closer come in and like lay it out like one more final deal, one more time. And it turns out, I think I mentioned it in the show, and then we'll have to stop the sound check because like we'll keep on going. The thing is, it's so the timeshare shit is so interesting, but when you start looking at the reviews and stuff, it's absolutely bananas. There's tons of complaints on Better Business Bureau. Mm. Like you could find so much information about how the salespeople will straight up lie. Like someone gets convinced, they sit at the closing table, they're starting to like sign some stuff. They start asking questions and the salespeople will just like lie to their face about what's on there, which is completely illegal, right? The thing is, they try to rush you through the closing. By then, you're trying to get out of there. You've been there a couple hours. Maybe you're hungry. You're not making good decisions. So my goal for next time, and maybe I told you this, I want to get to the closing table and just ask a million questions and then see if they like hold their shit together.
And then walk away.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because like until you sign it, then
I mean, it's not binding.
The thing is, they won't, as far as I know, because our other friend, like asked some questions about the HOA, like, hey, can I see the contract? Like, what kind of documents, it, like, just what would I be getting into? And they were like, oh, don't worry about those details. So it's like, they wouldn't let you see what was, anyway, I don't know if I have that much time, but it sounds fun, especially if you get a free vacation out of it.
Yeah. Oh, and we went last thing. Like, that was the last thing we did. Like, I think you can kind of go earlier or whatever. Sometimes they book your right. time. We were already checked out. Our bags were in the car. It was like the last thing we were doing. And prior to that, I enjoyed it. I really liked it there. I was like, this is a nice place. You know, they gave us some comp drinks. We went to the pool and they had a little private spa area. Did the one you had to have like an adults only, like spa area with?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They took us, like when we went on the tour, we did go through there. And they actually do try to schedule it that last day. We had to pull ours in because we had Georgie with us. So we didn't want to, like, we couldn't leave her in the car or whatever. Mm. So, but yeah, it looked like the spa was like super awesome and just the amenities look super nice. But again, they're on Airbnb. You could fucking rent them and it costs like a little bit more than whatever the maintenance fee, the HOA fee is. So yeah, it's BS.